Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill. Winston Churchill.
Winston stress. Suddenly, with a shock, the British public is made aware that a general strike is threatened. All industry, transport, all the cogs of the great machine which is modern life are to stop. The Prime Minister brings the news to Winston Churchill.
Churchill, I've just received some very serious news. The Trades Union Council has decided to call a general strike.
So that's what was in the wind. I sensed it.
Have you realized what's going to happen? Everything's going to be tied up. Everything. Not only the coal mines, but the ships, the trains, buses, all transport, in fact, and all trade.
Can't anything be done about it?
The council's adamant. They say their minds are made up, and no power on earth can prevent a strike.
Well, we shall just have to put up with it, that's all.
Put up with it? My dear Churchill, it's anarchy.
Not a bit of it. This isn't Russia, it's England.
I'm finding that hard to believe. But what's going to happen? What will the people do?
They'll do what they've always done. Grin and bear it. And those who drive cars can carry their less fortunate neighbors. Those who have hands can use them in carrying on the essential industries. We'll call for volunteers, swear in special constables, declare a state of emergency. Don't worry, nothing serious will happen.
Nothing serious? Why, hang it all, Churchill. We won't even be able to read the Times.
Oh, of course, they'll stop, too. I'd better go and see Lord Beaverbrook right away. That's my plan, gentlemen. As you must realize, nothing, except perhaps transport, is more important than the dissemination of news to the nation.
I realized that many years ago, Mr. Churchill. That's why I'm a newspaper man today.
Then you, most of all, Lord Beaverbrook, must see how necessary it is for the government to keep in touch with the people. I, too, am a journalist. Give me facilities, and I promise to produce a paper that will be readable, informative, and a powerful organ to influence the public.
No, no, no. It's impossible. Newspapers can't be run by amateurs, Mr. Churchill.
That's what the railway men said. Trains can't be driven by amateurs. But they are being driven by students, schoolboys, clerks, businessmen. Not being driven so smoothly, perhaps, but going forward, performing their task. And a newspaper can do the same. It may not be a first-class job, but people will be able to read it. Now, who's going to let me have their plant for the duration?
Well, you're welcome to use the Morning Post plant. But where'll you get compositors and printers? The mechanical staff's all on strike, too.
Well, I know a man who can help you there. Sid Long. He's the head of my technical department. As good a compositor as any man living. With the help of a couple of assistants, he might be able to do the job.
There you are, then. You'll see what can be done when we're put to the test. In less than 5 minutes, I've got a plant, a technical staff, and an editor.
And who's your editor?
Winston Churchill.
Oh.
I've always had an ambition to edit a London newspaper, and now my chance has come. I call it the British Gazette.
Nearly ready, Mr. Churchill. We could do with another half column on the last page.
Half a column. Any suggestions?
How a great newspaper is produced.
Oh, that might be asking for trouble.
Oh, hints to the lovelorn.
Well, that would hardly come under the heading of emergency news.
No.
No, what I want is something that will come home to every man, woman, and child in England, whether on the side of the strikers or against them. Propaganda is our best weapon, and you've got to make the most of it.
Why not have an article comparing the situation today with the situation of 1914-19? Call it, England Faces a Test.
That's it, that's it. You're a great help, Sid. As well as chief compositor, you'll be my chief sub-editor from now on. Well, Miss Lake, take this down, please. In 1914, we embarked with high hearts and keen resolve.
All ready, Mr. Churchill.
Let it go, then. The first issue of the British Gazette goes to bed.
My friends, colleagues, and fellow newspapermen. I have called you together in this Morning Post office
to celebrate a death. Yes, the death of the British Gazette. Over the ashes of this unique creature and creation, we mourn. We shed a tear or two. For this child of our imagination and industry. The general strike over. So, goodbye to the British Gazette. This I say to you, however. For the first time in the history of modern newspapers, the British Gazette was on the verge of paying its way by sales and without advertisements. An achievement indeed. An achievement due to your hard work, perseverance, enterprise, and ability.
Not forgetting our editor-in-chief.
Thanks. Goodbye to you. And may the British Gazette, now filed in the National Library, remind the people of the year 2000 that neither war, financial depression, nor general strike will stay the British people of the year 1926 from reading their morning paper. Yeah. Oh, my dear, the changes and twists and complexities of a man's political life. I began as a conservative. I went over to the liberals, then I went out. And being out, I became a constitutionalist. And now, I'm a hidebound conservative again.
I'm sure you'll be happier with the party than with any independent gathering, Winston.
Although, I'm always a rebel at heart. Well, perhaps those days have ended. Perhaps as an elder statesman.
Never that.
I repeat, perhaps my glorious adventure has ended. Now, as an elder statesman, I shall tread the path of political life with caution and circumspect. I shall grow old gracefully, making here and there an interesting and dignified speech. Meantime, I have a pleasant surprise for you.
I'm sure it'll be a very pleasant one.
We're going to end this tiring old year of 1926 with a few months abroad.
Oh, how lovely.
I want to visit Egypt, to ride on a camel, paint the pyramids and the Parthenon. Perhaps we'll have a flutter at Monte Carlo, eh? And I also want to hunt wild boar in Normandy. You know, Westminster invited me.
And a wonderful holiday. And you've earned it.
Last, but far from least, I want to meet Mussolini and just see what he's achieved in Italy. Only a few years since the March on Rome, I believe he's performed miracles. Well, let's make our plans, my friend. Upon all the wonderful achievements of a few years, Signor Mussolini, you've performed miracles.
Yes. Fascism has remade Italy. And you, my friend, and England. I would like to see England. I have said I love England. And that is indeed true. England. Lovely, sleepy, stodgy old England.
We're living through an age of peace, Excellency. We're asleep. Perhaps a long sleep which began with a doze in 1918. One day, we shall awake. When we are awakened by an alarm bell, eh?
An alarm bell? You speak in riddles, Mr. Churchill.
Not intentionally. I mean only that your efficiency, your order, your drilling of the youth of your country stirs me profoundly. I'm impressed by the manner in which a nation can be so nationalized.
That is fascism.
I can understand your ideas and appreciate your need for reorganization of your country. I've been always an admirer of a great edifice which grows brick by brick, always with the one architect's plan in mind. I wonder what that plan is, Excellency.
The old Romans constructed many great edifices. But if you journey around our old city, you will find them in ruins. Not so with fascism. Fascism, once born, lives forever. It is more than a system, a trained nation. It is a spiritual force ever growing, bringing with it the glory of expansion and strength.
It has been most interesting, Excellency. When I return to England, our quiet, old-fashioned England, I shall take with me a memory of your great work. More, I shall tell my colleagues what I have seen. Perhaps we might be able to get an idea or two, which even old England might be able to use, eh, Excellency?
Who knows? But if you must go, my hand in friendship, Mr. Churchill, a token of the friendship between our two countries.
Winston, is there anything wrong between you and Mr. Baldwin?
Wrong? Why?
Well, lately you always seem to take opposite viewpoints about everything.
I can't understand Baldwin lately. He seems utterly out of tune with Tory traditions. Yet he gets away with it. I don't know what to think of him.
You were very angry in the House this afternoon about that Indian bill. Yet Mr. Baldwin had his way, didn't he?
I honestly wouldn't be surprised at anything Baldwin might do these days. He's even capable of forming a coalition with the socialists. Of course, if that happens, I'd be finished completely. I've had great admiration for this policy, but now I ask myself, am I so completely wrong? Is Baldwin the greatest muddler of a prime minister Britain has known for many a generation?
There is no peace in England in those days of peace. The economic blizzard descends upon the world with all its wintry fury. A frantic setting wave on the New York Stock Exchange, which brings ruin to thousands, heralds the worst economic disaster in the world's history. And the blizzard blows to the four corners of the globe, breaking down existing standards of living, disrupting social legislation, multiplying unemployment a thousandfold. In this frozen atmosphere, Winston Churchill finds himself once again on the outside of the Conservatives and the Baldwin government. It is in this frozen atmosphere, too, that the Hitler cloud appears on the dim horizon.